Hey, how is everyone doing?
Better now that a couple of final assignments are submitted.
Always feels good to get those things off your plate. Yeah, it's hard to wait the last week of classes.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
How's everybody else?
How's everyone? Yeah, final push right to the end. Okay, so yeah, last topic.
I don't know if anyone else can hear you on Zoom, but I can't hear you at all. Now I can. That was odd. Sorry.
Worries, no thanks. It's always good to let me know when weird, mysterious things are happening. Okay, so yeah, we're looking at a very specific problem in a very specific context, aimed at a very specific population. But I think that there are some lessons that can be applied to a wider range of as well. But what we're talking about to start is just some of the cognitive and more general, broad psychological issues associated with athletic, specifically like high performance athletics. And there's a great deal of research in this area for a couple of specific reasons. And sort of the key reason is that there is a very clear relationship in high performance athletics between feelings of pressure. And performance. And in general, we'll look at some caveats to this, but in general, that relationship is a negative relationship such that increased pressure can sometimes lead to decreases or decrements athletic performance. In many high pressure situations, this is often in the sort of athletic sporting world referred to as choking. Like, so there's an athlete that's in a very high pressure scenario, a lot at stake. There's a high cost to them error. So then as a result, it's more likely that they're going to make an error, often in a scenario where their performance would normally be high. Some sort of standard examples in most athletic situations is say like level basketball player missing a foul shot when it's like the point is going to make a difference to win or lose a game. Golfer is missing what would otherwise consider very short cuts. Except in scenarios where you would expect high performance, but you instead get an error, you get a mistake, you get a drop in performance as a result of that pressure. So there's this whole sort of branch of psychology, usually just referred to as sports psychology. And it's not just in the cognitive psychology world. It draws on aspects of psychological research, but there are certainly cognitive issues and aspects associated with this negative relationship between pressure and athletic performance that we can start to explore from a cognitive perspective. Yeah, so we'll look at that within the athletic context, and then we'll see if there are some ways that we can think about how to apply these same types of theoretical ideas to a wider range of contexts. And I think that there are very straightforward ways to do that. So before we start to dig into it, and really what we're going to do throughout this class is we're going to take this very simple relationship and we're going to complicate it. We're going to start to look at some of the mediating factors that create this relationship between pressure and performance. So the first one, the sort of the clear obvious one is like if we had to think of one sort of mediating factor. And actually, I should check. Does everybody or does anybody know what I mean when I say mediating factor? Ashley's vaguely nodding. Ashley, do you want to take a shot at that? Or is that too much pressure? I might as well just leave the room now. That was awful. Okay, so when I talk about a mediating factor, so we've been looking at this relationship between pressure and performance, and the data show that often increased pressure leads to increased performance, but it's probably not a direct relationship, right? When I talk about a mediating factor, what that means is that there's some second factor where pressure has an influence on that second factor, and then that second factor has an influence on performance. Based on our reading of the chapter, and based on the sort of theoretical, the dominant theoretical perspectives on this, what is the standard mediating factor that controls the relationship between pressure and performance?
Is it what's at stake?
That's another mediating factor, but there's a larger, more primary one.
Having an audience.
Let's think even broader. Yeah, Maya's got it. This is the standard theoretical perspective, and actually, what you're identifying is some of the more the complexities and the nuances that we're going to start to explore.
Okay.
So we've slightly complicated this causal relationship. So it's not that pressure directly influences performance. Instead, what's happening is that the general theoretical perspective is that increased pressure has a positive relationship with anxiety. Positive not meaning good in this case, positive just in correlational language means that increased pressure tends to increase anxiety. Increased anxiety then has a negative correlation with performance, where more anxiety tends to be worse performance. There are some caveats to this. So some of the stuff that Afi was talking about, if we're talking about the sort of causal relationship and statistical language that people tend to use, instead of a mediating factor, what Afi is describing is a moderating factor, where a moderating factor is something that changes these relationships. And we know, so what Ashley was identifying is different reasons that pressure might do increase anxiety, which will then have a potential decrease on performance. So what Ashley is identifying is that, okay, we have some potential candidates for the reasons that pressure might lead to increased anxiety, something like there is an audience, which might... You know, something like having people watching, so having a camera present or having an audience present might lead to, if that's a source of pressure, that might increase anxiety by eliciting feelings of potential embarrassment associated with poor performance. High performance athletics is often what actually was saying, what is at stake? Well, there's often financial incentives, perceived incentives, and performing poorly, for lack of a better word, for losing an athletic competition at high enough levels. That means, has career implications. If you're a better performer, you make more money. This is especially true in things like golf that are, solo sports, where your performance in a particular tournament varies very literally very closely tied to the amount of money you make during that tournament. The higher you rank, the more money. There's also prestige costs, those are future career incentives. And again, the pressure of these high stakes scenarios could potentially increase anxiety. But some of these caveats that we're talking about, we immediately see that there are a bunch of findings demonstrating that this relationship is more complicated than anything. So it's not even always the case that increased pressure leads to greater anxiety or leads to lower performance. So, for example, in the text we have this Misagno et al. 2010 study where they were hockey players, and they found that there's a difference here. So for something like an audience, so whether there are people watching or there's a camera present, that did lead to increased feelings of anxiety and performance. But providing financial incentives for high performance actually had the opposite of that. It was more of a motivating factor rather than creating anxiety, where performance ended up actually increasing. So it depends. It gets complicated. Based on your reading of the chapter, what are some other caveats, or this is the section where the authors are outlining some of the common assumptions about pressure, anxiety, and performance, and demonstrating some of the cases in which they don't necessarily. What are some other caveats? What are some other questions? Try to push it in some direction. So if we're just focusing on, for example, pressure, over the course of an athletic competition, it could be a single match game round, depending on the sport we're talking about, or it could say be like a weekend long tournament. How consistent or stable is pressure over the course of an athletic performance or competition? Like, does it say relatively consistent? Does it change, fluctuate? It's consistent? Agreement, disagreement? So let's look at some examples. I'm unfortunately inclined to disagree. So let's just think. We'll get some. If somebody feels like volunteering, pick some sort of sports athletic competition of choice. Volleyball. Okay, so let's imagine two scenarios, and Maya can try to provide some information, or other people can volunteer some information. So you imagine you're a high caliber volleyball player. You're in a game. You have one of two situations. So typically, let's imagine we're in the sort of standard setup where each game is up to 25 points. We have two different scenarios, and I want you to imagine the pressure that you would potentially feel in each of those situations. You are currently serving. And it is you are down 24-20. You are currently serving. How much pressure do you feel in the scenario? The other team is 1 point away from winning, you're 2 points away from winning. Compared to the other scenario, you're serving and you are up 24-0. There's a lot of pressure. In which scenario? Yeah, so you're down. It's like it's very close. We're at like what would be called a high stakes scenario, right? So like you better serve well, because if you have to win these next 3 points, that's the only way for you to really, you at least have to win this next point. Because if they get a point, then it's over. You're up 24-0. You have some wiggle room. You can screw up without a lot of consequences. So pressure is likely not stable, but depends on a lot of factors. Depends on how close the competition is at any given time. Empirically, high performance athletes will feel more pressure when they're performing poorly. They'll feel more pressure when their opponents are performing well. And you'll obviously, sort of intuitively, but also empirically demonstrated, that you'll feel more pressure when the competition is close compared to when it's quite distant. It's the same case with, like, if you are in the opposite scenario, 24-0, pressure also just kind of like, what? Like, we know we're not going to pull this off. So pressure fluctuates, which of course means that this isn't going to be like a very, it's not going to be a very simple relationship to measure and examine, because pressure is going to fluctuate over time, which means that anxiety is going to fluctuate over time, which means that performance will fluctuate over time. And that combined with the fact that pressure is going to fluctuate over time for different reasons complicates matters further. The fact that, you know, the athlete's own performance influences pressure makes things, of course, very complicated, because that means there's like a feedback loop, right? So pressure can increase anxiety, which can decrease performance, which could then further increase pressure. One of the other points that I think is worth highlighting is that there's, you know, what we're eventually going to do is we're going to start sort of filling in this causal relationship. We're going to add more factors, sort of getting into some of the cognitive factors that theoretically might lead to increased anxiety, increasing performance. There is one very common explanation that I think we're going to see fairly quickly, and it's kind of like the motivation for the primary theory we want to examine, doesn't seem to really hold up empirically. And the proposal, a little asterisk saying that we're going to dismiss this, is that the primary mediating factor between anxiety and performance is something called skill focus. Does anybody want to take a shot at defining what I mean by skill focus?
But basically, where you focus on the skill, like, attributes of your of that sport that you do, in order to like execute like your performance in a way.
Sorry, do you mind just repeating some of that? I got a bit of crackling, at least on.
It's basically, I think, where you focus on the characteristics or aspects of your skills that help execute your performance in that sport.
Okay, yeah, okay, thanks. That was easier to hear. Yeah, so the general idea is, like, so skill focus is something where it's like you actually start paying attention to exactly what you're doing within a given athletic scenario. And so it's worth noting that, just likely for convenience and any ease of measurement and examination, the types of sports or sporting activities or tasks that people tend to examine are things that are relatively sort of like smaller. They're easier to measure. They're less complicated. So things like putting in golf, foul shots in basketball, things like penalty kicks in soccer, things like that. And so what I'm describing is the idea of skill focus is sort of paying explicit conscious attention to the actual movements involved in that task and that athletic activity. And the concern, or the sort of older theoretical perspective, is that this is a bad thing for high performance athletes. It's probably a beneficial thing for people who are athletes or just not athletes in general. And it all relates to this idea of practice and automaticity. So high performance athletes, when you have these things like putting, kicking a penalty kick, shooting a foul shot, these are things that you practice again and again and again. And the idea is that over time, the purpose of that high intensive drilling or practice is to make it so that it's automatic. You don't have to think about it. And there's some evidence suggesting that when you have high performance athletes that have these very automated motor programs or motor coordinations, if you have them focus on what they're actually physically doing, their performance, You're not allowing them to rely on that very well practiced automatic process. So when you have them have to think about it, then performance goes down. And regardless of our athletic ability, we all have very well practiced automatic motor programs. A very simple example: how many of us put a lot of thought into walking? We don't have to really think about walking; just do it. And if you had to like explain to somebody how to walk, like how to get your muscles to walk, probably that's not a great job. They would, once drive the car for a while, think about it, things like that. Yeah, the idea is that the older theoretical idea is that when athletes are in a state of high anxiety, this focuses their attention onto what they're actually doing. So it increases skill focus, which then loses that automaticity, which then decreases performance. The story makes sense, but the empirical evidence doesn't necessarily support this. At least it doesn't support it as the primary mediating factor between anxiety and performance. There are some, studies that seem to, measure what athletes are thinking about in high pressure and high anxiety situations, just through, self-report, which is not always the greatest way to measure. But through self-report, in a lot of these studies, on average, of all of the thoughts that athletes are having in high pressure situations, most studies are showing skill focus, so like about what I'm actually doing, as being self-reported about 4% of the time. So if athletes are only thinking about what they're actually doing, taking skill focus around 4% of the time in high pressure situations, it seems unlikely that that's the primary driving factor that mediates the relationship between anxiety and performance. Additionally, there are other cases where there are some studies showing that skill focus can actually sometimes a good thing. So there's a study of ski jumpers who seem to, in that particular context, really carefully skill focus, like in real time, but they're in the air, monitoring where they are, how quickly they're rotating, and making stuff. So that doesn't seem to be it. Okay, so we still have, that means we have to do a bit of work and try to determine a different competing theoretical explanation for why increased anxiety can potentially lead to decreased performance. And the alternative theoretical explanation is sort of the focus of this chapter, and is this idea or a theoretical idea known as intentional control, or is usually abbreviated to. So we'll sort of break down exactly how this seems to work, and we'll go through some of those general caveats. The really broad perspective here is that we're going to have we have these, what we might refer to as sort of central executive intentional processes. So the components or cognitive processes in the brain that sort of govern our ability to pay attention to some things and ignore others. And the general idea is that there's a negative relationship between feelings of anxiety and many aspects of those central executive control processes. And the two attentional processes that attentional control theory tends to focus on are the attentional processes of inhibition and shifting. They're connected and related ideas, but they do have some distinctions. So when I talk about the attentional processes of inhibition and shifting, what do I mean? What are the basic roles of inhibition and shifting? So even just really generally, what is the term inhibition usually refer to? Yeah, preventing. So in an intentional context, when we talk about inhibition from a central executive attention framework, what we're talking about is our ability to ignore irrelevant information, to not pay attention to the things that don't really matter. Now, attentional shifting is it's related to inhibition in the sense that it kind of requires inhibition to some degree, but attentional shifting is exactly what it sounds like, actually changing our attention from one piece of information to the other. Because, of course, in a dynamic situation such as an athletic competition, what you should be paying attention to changes and fluctuates over time. So those two processes of attentional inhibition and attentional shifting, they themselves are typically positively associated with athletic performance. If we're better at attentional inhibition and better at attentional shifting, then that tends to increase our performance because it means that we're paying attention to the most important, relevant information at any time and ignoring the things that aren't important. And so if you're shooting a foul shot in a basketball game, you are paying attention to and shifting your attention to position of the ball on your head, position of your feet, the back of the rim to accurately make that shot. You are not paying attention to the potential audience is watching you, not paying attention to those feelings of anxiety. And if you're doing all that well, then you're likely to perform. And if instead something is preventing or reducing those the effectiveness of those attentional processes, then we expect a decrease in performance. So that, in a very like simplified sort of diagram, is the basic idea of attentional control theory, at least as applied to athletics. And we'll start to look at some evidence supporting some of these things. But the general idea is that when we're in positions of high pressure, so high stakes scenarios, there's a potential substantial cost to poor performance. This is going to have a positive relationship with anxiety, so it's going to increase feelings of anxiety. Anxiety has a negative relationship with these attentional processes of inhibition and shifting. Inhibition and shifting have a positive relationship with athletic performance. So ultimately, if you end up in a scenario where you have higher pressure, so high pressure means high anxiety, which means decreased attentional processes, which is going to mean decreased performance. Is that sort of chain of events making sense? Any questions about that? So that's the basic theoretical explanation. And of course, that means, you know, as a sort of relatively recent application of the theory, that means now it needs to be tested with some sort of empirical research. So the general scientific process in this case would be to derive predictions from the theory. The theory is going to make predictions about relationships and causal effects on different types of behavior. And the theory is going to survive to the extent that those predictions are confirmed in empirical research. So based on this this causal structure and based on your reading of the chapter, what would you identify as some key predictions that this theory would make that you could then test empirically? That's something I should give you some time to think about and discuss. Why don't we do that? So we won't spend much time on this. I'll give you like, you know, 10 minutes just to discuss as a group. And again, the idea is like I'm asking you to sort of like put on your like psychological scientist hats a little bit and think about from this theory where we have this and to like give us some information in the right direction. I mean, the key here is really like the key aspect of attentional control theory is that those attentional processes are the primary cognitive mediator that lead to this pain between pressure, anxiety, and performance. So if you are trying to think of ways to test that theory, the first thing you need to do is start to identify, okay, so what are some predictions that that theory would make about athletic performance in different scenarios? And then you could test those predictions empirically. So just give us like 10 minutes just to brainstorm as a group. Some predictions you could make in this theory. And we'll look at some of the research that's been done. Does that make sense? Okay, cool. I will come back in about that. Okay. Yeah, I mean, this kind of task is difficult. I mean, it's like research skills like this are kind of like athletic performance, something that requires requires some practice. So there are kind of two key predictions that we can begin by driving from this. So if it's the case that it's these attentional processes that tend to lead to increased performance. That are the primary factor driving the sort of choking effect, the effect of pressure on performance. If it's the case that pressure leads to anxiety, which then disrupts those attentional processes, which disrupts athletic performance, what we can take advantage of is the fact that there are just natural individual differences in the effectiveness of those attentional processes from person to person. People just differ. In their performance in attention. And we have a giant pile of ways to measure those types of attentional processes. We've covered some of them much earlier in the course, and the chapter outlines a few of the findings related to those types of attentional processes. So one sort of general prediction we can make is that people who are just naturally better, like tend to sort of more effective at regulating those attentional processes, should be less impacted in high pressure scenarios. They're starting from a higher point in those attentional processes, so it's harder to disrupt them. So we'd expect people who are truly good at inhibition and switching to be less affected by pressure. As a sort of general prediction, does that make sense? If that can be established, then the second sort of general set of predictions that we'll start to examine a bit is that if you can implement some sort of training procedure that increases the effectiveness of those attentional processes, you should be able to then experimentally reduce the effects of pressure on performance. And of course, that's where we're going to see the strongest application, because that's an actual intervention where we can do something. Yeah, does that make sense as a sort of general prediction? So if we look at some of at this point, relatively limited research that's tested some of these predictions. So far, we get some pretty solid support for this attentional control theory perspective on high performance athletics. So there, let's start with inhibition. There are many tasks that we can use that we can sort of put people into in an artificial lab scenario that are meant to measure our ability to inhibit. Just as just one example, there's something known as a go/no-go task, and it's a very simple procedure. It's essentially like I'm going to show you a bunch of stimuli. They might be letters, numbers, usually something that's not that difficult to process. If it's in a green font, then you're supposed to press a button that makes a response. So say there are numbers, you're gonna press one button. If it's odd, one button even. But then on a small percentage of trials, it's red. And what you're supposed to do in this case is just not press anything. So this is an inhibitory task. And most of the time you're performing one thing, but when the font's in red, then you have to inhibit that response. You're trying to do this as quickly as possible when it's green. So often people will make errors and they'll accidentally respond, which is a failure to inhibit that response. So that's just one of many experimental tasks or lab tasks that people could use to measure this attentional process of inhibition. And we can leverage that to test some of these predictions. So first of all, we just, in general, high-performance athletes tend to be better at inhibiting distractions, likely because it's just something that they have to practice on a regular basis. But even within that restricted group, we get this very consistent prediction, sorry, consistent with the prediction finding that athletes who tend to score higher on these types of distraction inhibiting tasks tend to perform better under high pressure scenarios. So another way of framing that is they tend not to show the same increase in performance when experiencing pressure, or even when experiencing anxiety. There's some, again, limited, but some research demonstrating this particular research was done with tennis players, that if you give high-performing tennis players training these types of inhibition tasks, so, you know, kind of practice and get better and better at it. With most of these lab tasks, we will get better over time, as boring as the task might be. That directly leads to an increase in performance, especially under high-pressure scenarios. Any questions or thoughts about that? So that gives us some again, preliminary but fairly supportive evidence in favor of the role of intentional ambition in athletic performance, and particularly in the ability of you know, high efficiency attentional inhibition in sort of reducing that negative impact of pressure on performance. We get similar evidence in favor of the role of attentional shifting as well. So either based on your reading of the chapter or if it's an idea you've encountered before, is anyone familiar with this idea of the quiet high in athletic performance? Sorry, Jared, not runner's high, quiet high. It's a general idea in a lot of athletic performance. It's specifically applied to scenarios in which there's like a relevant target that you should be sort of looking at. So if you're in an athletic situation where there's like a relevant spatial location, something like the hole that you're putting to in golf, a target on a dartboard, for a foul shot, a net for a soccer penalty kick, anything where there's like a specific location that you're supposed to look, there's a very consistent finding that if you track people's eye movements during these types of tasks, one very strong predictor of strong performance is how long they are looking at that target compared to looking anywhere else. And it's quite precise, very specific. You get this notable spike in performance if you have a fixation, so people are looking at that point for at least 100 milliseconds. So it doesn't need to be long, very fast, for at least 100 milliseconds within a degree of error, what's known as a degrees in visual angle. So it's just like if you're looking straight on, just how far you're deep. And it's within 3 degrees of visual angle. And then it keeps going from there. So the longer you're looking at that spatial location, the higher your performance tends to be. And of course, you can imagine this is going to get drawn away if you're not good at inhibiting distracting information, if you're not good at shifting from location to location, especially in dynamic situations. Where the relevant spatial location is, of course, what you change from time to time. So if we go back to Maya's example of volleyball, you know, the ball moves, so you need to fixate on different points at different times. And again, we get this very clear set of results supporting the pivotal role of attentional shifting, as usually measured in this case by this quiet eye. So if we put people into scenarios, where we're able to track their eye movements during some sort of athletic task. Finding one is that feelings of anxiety are negatively correlated with gaze duration on the relevant location, so people don't look at the right place for as long if they're anxious. And much like this inhibitory training, training people on shifting tasks, so any sort of lab task that requires people to shift from position to position quickly, can be as simple as like, say like a, you know, a stimulus is going to appear in the four corners of a screen at random and you just have to find it as quickly as possible. Training people on that type of task will both increase their gaze duration to this relevant wide eye location and increase their performance in high pressure situations. Questions, thoughts about that? So that's, you know, some supportive evidence in favor of this attentional control theory. And also comes with a few direct applications of what athletes might be able to do to maximize their performance in high pressure situations. So the key idea here is sort of there seems to be evidence supporting the fact that just training on these very low-level attentional tasks or actions can, in fact, actually lead to an increase in athletic performance and sort of set a protective factor against the influence of pressure on performance. One other thing that we want to talk about is there's also some research aimed at examining that relationship, the relationship between pressure and anxiety, because you know, one way to improve performance in these situations is to approach things at the level of attention. The other is to approach things at the level of the relationship between pressure and anxiety, with the general goal that if you can create some sort of intervention that makes it such that pressure does not lead to an increase in anxiety, then of course if you stop the chain right at that point, then you're not going to get. Interestingly, a lot of the research in this particular area kind of relates to some of like emotion regulation, reappraisal kind of techniques that we were discussing previously. A lot of these sort of CBT kind of techniques where we have, in this case, you can have a sort of reinterpret what's happening in a high pressure situation in ways that are going to prevent that pressure from being. So even if it's not drawing from the reading of the chapter, like what are some ways that you think, if you're just brainstorming, what are some things you can do using some of these types of reappraisal methods, interpretational techniques, to make it such that a high-performance athlete would be less likely to feel anxiety in high-pressure situations? We do at least get some evidence that there are at least naturally occurring protective factors. So one very simple finding is that pressure is much less likely to lead to anxiety for very high self-confidence. Athletes, people that have very high levels of self-confidence tend not to experience anxiety and high pressure. So a couple of things that have been demonstrated to work is that requiring, so sort of encouraging people to reconceptualize mistakes and errors. The reconceptualization from a CBT perspective is encourage athletes to reconceptualize errors as just things that happen. The high-performance athletes in particular tend to have a bit of a mindset where errors are forbidden, errors are not expected to happen. So when they do happen, that leads to increased anxiety. If you can have people reconceptualize errors as something that happen, and what you can try to do is just reduce the frequency with which they happen, then we tend to see a decrease in the relationship between pressure and anxiety. Another technique that's been shown to be fairly effective is to encourage people to reappraise or reinterpret their feelings of anxiety as feelings of excitement. And this takes advantage of the fact that physiologically, anxiety and excitement have quite a bit of overlap. One of the things that sort of happen to your body and the physical sensations that come with it, they're not identical, but they do overlap pretty substantially. So you can fairly effectively train people to interpret feelings of anxiety as feelings of excitement, again, which has been shown to then reduce any influence of pressure on performance. One sort of odd one. Is to encourage what are called avoidance coping strategies as opposed to solution-focused or emotion-focused coping strategies. Are different coping strategies in response to stress something that we've encountered in other classes before? Quite briefly, so it's like there are different sort of coping mechanisms or approaches that people can take in response to stress. Something like a solution or a problem-focused coping strategy aims at like thinking about ways to resolve the source of stress. Emotion-based coping strategies that focus on what are you feeling, why are you feeling this, and sort of being able to just like grapple with and deal with those emotions. And avoidant coping strategies essentially involve ignoring the problem. There's this odd thing where for some reason avoidant coping strategies tend to reduce or remove this relationship between pressure and anxiety. The likely mechanism seems to be that, well, it's just like just ignoring it, just don't pay attention to it. I would not necessarily recommend this as a viable solution because outside of athletics, it's sort of uniformly shown that avoidant coping strategies are the worst possible option that tends to lead to a bunch of long-term negative outcomes, both on physical and mental health. And then the final strategy that's outlined in the chapter is, again, I think a bit of an odd one that we can discuss a little bit. And the suggestion is that if you can encourage athletes to reinterpret the overall situation, and the reinterpretation involves two things. It says, so to reinterpret failures or errors so that you don't interpret them as increasing the likelihood of a loss. And if you reinterpret the stakes as being unimportant and low, then that can reduce the influence of pressure on anxiety. I find this one a little bit weird because, at least in my view, it seems to be encouraging people to reinterpret a situation in a way that's inaccurate, because both of those interpretations are correct. There are stakes. If you're in a championship game and you lose, then you don't win the championship. And if you're performing poorly, that does increase the likelihood that you're going to lose. So it seems a little bit weird to me, but it's really just a theoretical suggestion at this point. And if the empirical studies we demonstrate that this is effective, then it's effective. And we're starting to summarize some of that a little bit. Again, a lot of this is very early, very preliminary, just of research. But it is demonstrating so far that we're getting fairly close to sort of pinpointing some of the key factors that cause decreases in performance in high pressure situations, at least in athletics. We're also identifying some potential interventions that seem to be effective at reducing or preventing that relationship, which is, of course, that's important if you're a high performance athlete, and it's, I guess, to a lesser extent, important if you are somebody who's particularly invested in the performance of a particular sports team or athlete. With that as a bit of an interim summary, any thoughts, questions, clarifications? So I want to be like mindful of our levels and that with the fair term. So if it makes sense, what I'd like to do is just push through for a little bit rather than taking a break, and then end fairly early, if that makes sense for everybody. That seem reasonable? Okay, so I mean, all I really want to do before we sort of sign off for the day and for the course. Is the reading response prompt that I gave is like, well, so this is good. Like I like sports, I like athletics. I wouldn't, you know, I don't watch sports that much, but playing them. But in terms of an overall social problem, this isn't necessarily going to be maximizing, optimizing performance. Athletics, certainly important to some people, as I mentioned, very important to people who are athletes. But as a broader social problem, not the biggest, not the most generalizable. So in the question, I was just asking us to think about other contexts in which this attentional control theory idea might be applicable at a broader level. And so the idea is that, like, there are likely many other scenarios in which pressure and anxiety are going to lead to decreases in performance, efficiency, effectiveness, increased errors, and in context, you don't want those. But it's sort of briefly, I haven't really read through those responses yet, but just briefly want to have a little bit of discussion of some of the contexts and ideas that you were thinking about and wrote about. So we'll just kind of go through, and anybody who's comfortable sharing the general idea, we can just open that up for. Does that make sense? Okay, so why don't we'll just go one by one, and if you don't really want to share your thoughts at this point, you can just say so, we'll pass. So come on, why don't we start with you? What were some of the ideas? So what are some of the applications of attentional control here to drive? Yeah, so I think there's some interesting ideas here. So just in case people on Zoom weren't able to catch all of that, especially with the microphone apparently kind of not working consistently today, the general idea was, so we have driving, and I completely agree. So like attentional processes are critically important in driving, to ignore or inhibit information from other sources. We'd be able to shift from place to place, given that things change and driving to the dynamic situation. So for sure, those intentional processes are entirely critical. Additionally, if I'm adding to that, anxiety, I mean, not anxiety, driving for a lot of people can produce anxiety, especially like new drivers who don't have that experience, aren't very autistic in their driving abilities, especially in very high situations. Experience anxiety, which we reasonably expect to reduce the effectiveness of those intentional processes. So if we're sort of brainstorming as a group, what are some things we could do? And it might be some of the same situations. You know, for example, if somebody's a particularly anxious driver, then it might be worth maybe going through some of that intentional training or going through some of that reappraisal kind of process. Yeah, and again, that's sort of like it's that entire like reappraisal thing was sort of striking us as odd in the context of athletics. It's even weirder in like actual high. Don't want to be like, well, it doesn't matter. Because it does. I am very cool sharing some of your thoughts. No, that's all awesome. So Annie Mai is talking about sort of the idea of exam anxiety, which is a substantial, very common problem. And we know that everything we're talking about with athletics, when students are experiencing anxiety around academic performance, especially in the context of an exam, it does in fact decrease performance. You can demonstrate this empirically. So feelings of anxiety, some sort of academic style test, and even if they're not anxious about the test, if you just induce some feelings of anxiety, then they perform worse, likely for the same reason that you're not paying attention, you're distracted by those internal thoughts, you have fewer attentional resources to allocate to the exam, you don't do as well, you miss things, you read things incorrectly, and so it does cause these it causes these problems. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these, Maya, a lot of the interventions you're talking about are sort of at that stage of the relationship between like pressure and anxiety. So, and that there's something wise to that, right? I mean, you can just address the feelings of anxiety in general, then that stops any reduction in attentional processes, which is going to stop any decrease in performance ability. Annie, are you comfortable talking about your response at all?
I can, yeah. It's very similar to kind of what we discussed, particularly driving, just in terms of the underlying principles. But obviously, like things to minimize the distractions of like inhibition function, for example. Just to do, I'm just getting out for a minute, refresh myself. So of course, in order to drive legally, we practice and develop our skills, which later get put to the test, and therefore either pass or fail. But obviously, as time passes, people generally get quite relaxed, and it can becomes more of like an implicit skill. However, obviously, when we're driving, there can be quite a few distractions, and like any task that relies on our pre-developed skills and inhibition, if we have surrounding distractions or think too much about the task at hand, it would impair our inhibition function. So in order to prevent or possibly prevent this, driving in a car, not speaking to people, like not engaging in conversation, have music down on low volume to avoid distractions, refrain from eating, and things like that, which obviously can result in fewer accidents and issues on the road.
Yeah, so it's interesting that you're identifying some of you are having overlap in the context you're identifying. But to an extent, that makes sense. I mean, the sort of key when we're thinking about the ways that we can apply these types of theories, I mean, it's a matter of identifying, like what are the other types of scenarios that seem to involve the same potential causal chain? Well, we have many scenarios in which we might feel anxiety during those situations. We have many scenarios such as bribing, exam, like that, where we know that increased feelings of anxiety will affect performance. And there seems to be something fairly general about this attentional control framework, because these are also scenarios in which we know that reducing the effectiveness or efficiency of attentional processes also does with performance. So Annie was talking about all these different distractions. And there's no shortage of empirical research demonstrating that, regardless of even if there's no anxiety involved, anything that draws attention away from driving decreases driving performance. So things like eating, talking on the cell phone, texting, things like that. So if we just then bring that one level up, if anxiety can become a source of distraction and draw away those attentional resources, then we have no reason not to expect a similar decrease in performance. Jaron, any thoughts on your end? Let's wait for something in the chat if you're writing anything. Oh, Jared, I did see you. I just noticed your direct message in the chat. I'll send you an email. Okay, we got something going on. Okay, let's see what we have. Okay, so Jaren's describing a study that involves looks like you're looking at using oxytocin treatment to reduce distraction and increase emotion regulation. Yeah, so I mean, what you're highlighting is just the sort of more general perspective here that these sort of emotion regulation, reappraisal, reinterpretation issues, or in this case, what's pharmaceutical intervention, that is a sort of very generalized, very broad way to reduce these types of sort of cognitive performance deficits. You know, when we talk about things like CBT or talk about emotion regulation or any sort of intervention that helps with emotion regulation, it tends to be pretty exclusively in the context of mental health. Of course, that's an extremely important application of those ideas. But what we're seeing here is that its reach might actually be higher, that we have these non-clinical, non-therapy-based, non-health-based situations in which things like anxiety and deficient emotion regulation cause higher problems. So yeah, really just to sort of summarize that general idea that we're all hitting on, anxiety and emotion regulation are not just a mental health thing. They have wider implications. They influence our cognitive processes, which influences many things. Any final thoughts, questions? Okay, so Yvonne's question for the people on Zoom is about like whether this applies to things like substance use disorders, addiction. Yeah, I mean that's a complex problem. I mean, like of course, substance use disorders are influenced and caused by many, many factors that interact with each other in complex ways. Can you maybe expand on your thought a little bit? So what are you seeing as the potential application of these specific ideas we're talking about to something like a substance use disorder? Okay, so the CBM, right? The cognitive bias modification. Very similar, yeah. I mean, it could. I think it relates, I think something like cognitive bias modification could fairly directly relate to some of the stuff we're talking about now that provides a way to potentially, you know, draw attention away, like for athletes or for people in other contexts, draw attention away from those distracting, anxiety-inducing factors, which I suspect would likely lead to increases in performance. The application to substance use disorders is not as clear to me. I think some of the, I mean, like CBT in particular, is one helpful thing. Just substance use disorders are very challenging because you get this combination of psychological factors, of social factors, of genetic factors. You know, the actual most addictive substances, there's a very clear biological reason. You know, we discussed the issues of tolerance, withdrawal, know, those types of big physiological responses are those factors or facets of a substance use disorder require different methods, different treatments. So there are different types of interventions that would address different aspects of a substance disorder. But some of these like reappraisal kind of things, like those do help with some of the social and psychological effects, certainly. Anything else? Drugs certainly be crazy. Okay. Well, in that case, let's call it early. Let's call it for the course. Of course, I mean, we still have, like the final exam coming up on the 18th. I'll send out some details over email over the next couple of days. Just so we're all on the same page, just keep an eye out for all of that. Thank you for the course. There's lots of really good, sustained discussion. I really enjoyed all the reading responses. Everyone had excellent insights, very, very good ideas. I haven't personally heard anything about course evaluations, but I suspect that they'll be available on Podbean again at some point. So just keep an eye out for that. I do appreciate the back and try to incorporate it into future versions of the course. So and then as we sort of go on, I'll start providing feedback on reading responses that I haven't evaluated yet, and of course the final version of the case study paper. We'll go from there. Again, thank you. I had lots of fun. Of course, that's all that really matters. Have an awesome rest of the day. Get some rest as we get to the end of the term. Between now and then, as always, you know how to reach me.